on Petawashte. Pidamia for joining me this week again as we read Water Lily by Ella Deloria for our program, Ohomene Iotaka, meaning gather in a circle and sit down. It's time for storytelling. So last week, we ended where the camp is trying to figure out how to handle a death that has happened within camp. And the death, of course, was a young man. And so there's a lot of anger and frustration and trying to figure out the best way to deal with this so that others aren't hurt. And at the same time, it is a fair and just punishment for the other man who committed this murder. So let's begin. And we begin with Yankton. And he says, "Yes, my friend, I am." Oh, no. We begin with Yankton. And he is saying, "My friend, there is still that other way to deal with a murderer, which, to my mind, is the noblest of all because it brings the best results." Yankton remarked, "I wonder if you are familiar with the kinship appeal." "Yes, my friend, I am, though I have never witnessed it. I have heard those who have speak of it with high respect," the father answered. "But tell the children here, I think our people have never devised anything loftier than that." So Yankton described how he once saw the kinship appeal used to settle a score. The enraged young relatives of the slain man debated the kind of punishment they ought to mete out to the slayer who was still at large. As they debated, their eldest relative, a man of great influence in the entire tribe, sat listening as though in accord with them. After they had all talked themselves out, he began to speak. With consummate skill, he gave them the impression that he was going along with them all the way. "My kindred, cousins, brothers, sons, and nephews all, today we have been made to weep without shame, men though we are. Someone has dared to do us an injury and slain our young relative. Has he not thereby grossly insulted our family pride and our honor? Our kinsman was young. He too loved life. He was not ready to die, yet he is dead. Should we not vow that his slayer too shall die? And should we not go out forthwith and kill him? Very well, then. Why do we sit here talking? Why not give the murderer his due at once?" He smoked quietly after this, calm and steady. In due time, he resumed speaking. But now he had changed his tact. And yet, my kindred, there is a better way. That the fire of hate may not burn on in his heart or in yours. We shall take that better way. Go now to your homes, look over your possessions, and bring here the thing you most prize, a horse, or weapons, or wearing apparel, or a blanket. Easy ways and empty words may do for others. We are men of another make, so let us take the harder way, the better way. If but few are able to do that, then let us be that few. The gifts you bring shall go to the murderer for a token of our sincerity and our purpose. Though he has hurt us, we shall make him something to us, a relative, in place of the one who is not here. Was the dead your brother? Then this man shall be your brother, or your uncle, or your cousin. As for me, the dead was my nephew. Therefore his slayer shall be my nephew. And from now on he shall be one of us. We shall regard him as though he were our dead kinsman returned to us. Yankton and his host smoked a while. Then he said, "My friend, that was a tremendous proposal, would you not say?" "Indeed it was," his host agreed. "And what assurance of leadership that elder kinsman must have had to dare suggest such a thing. For it required of each man to undergo inner battle with himself and to master his pride and anger first. That is not easy. I take it they all did so?" "Yes, they accepted what their elder kinsman said, because they saw that it was right. They saw it was easy enough to fight violence with violence. Killing was the work of a moment. But to take the murderer as a relative, after what he had done, and to live in sincerity and creative goodwill with him, day in and day out to the end of his life, that was something else. You may well imagine how proud must have been the spirit of the slain youth to see his relatives doing the harder thing. Now, on the appointed day, the slayer was brought to the council teepee. He was brave. He did not turn to run away. He knew he had killed a man and was ready to pay with his life. Even so, not knowing his exact fate, he entered with his eyes averted, steeling himself for the worst. He did not try to infer the decision from the councilmen's faces. He did not want them to pity him. He would not have men say, supposing him to be afraid, "Poor fellow." Like some hunted animal, he tried to detect mercy in men's eyes. The spokesman said, offering him the pipe of peace, "Smoke. With these your new kinsmen seated here, for they have chosen to take you to themselves in place of one who is not here." Hearing these words, the man was visibly unnerved, and he began to tremble. "It is their desire that henceforth you shall go in and out among them without fear. By these presents, which they have brought here for you, they would have you know that whatever love and compassion they had for him is now yours forever." As he said these words, tears began to course down the slayer's cheeks. You see, he had been neatly trapped by loving kinship. And you may be sure that he proved himself an even better kinsman than many who had right of birth, because the price of his redemption had come so high. Then Yankton added, "I know this well. I was one of the younger and most enraged cousins of the slain man. But I learned then that there is no more powerful agent for ensuring goodwill and smothering the flame of hate than the kinship of humans." Water Lily and Sacred Horse and the rest sat very still after this. It was too tremendous. There were no words for it. The men smoked mechanically on in silence, and the women sat with lowered heads, waiting for someone else to speak first. Finally, in a most everyday manner that broke the spell, the woman of the teepee threw some light sticks on the fire, and when it flared up, she once more tilted her black three-legged pot to the light and peered in. "Let me see. Yes, There is some food remaining. I'll just heat it up quickly. These chilly autumn evenings, it is good to swallow something hot before going to bed. And as she busied herself in a practical way, everyone shifted a little and came back to the present. They ate the food while talking of inconsequential matters until a woman's shrill cry broke out somewhere. Alas, someone else has died. Yankton's words were ominous. This afternoon, a baby died across the way, too. I wonder who this time. Redleaf had been lying on his stomach with elbows planted and chin nestling in cupped hands. Now he added his bit of news. There's a whole family down sick over that way, he said, and raised his chin momentarily to indicate the direction. Oh, so many deaths. So much sickness, Water Lily sighed, thinking of her grandfather far away. It was long past midnight when she and Sacred Horse walked homeward, hand in hand in the dark. They were both sobered by the sorrowful atmosphere that pervaded the entire circle, by the wailing that started up here and there as the news spread. It was a portentous sound. Anything could happen on the morrow. Water Lily sat in her teepee doing fancy work. 2 days ago, her husband had taken some horses that his father had promised sometime during the summer to a relative in a distant camp. He had left before sunrise the day after their visit with the social parents across the circle. His elder sister, Echo, could be heard just outside. No, no, daughter, you may not go along. Stay here with your aunt. I shall be back soon. Then she looked in at Water Lily. Sister-in-law, I am going to a teepee yonder where a kinswoman has just died. Your little niece Robin will stay. I do not like to take her to a death because she always screams so whenever I wail, trying to help me. Of course, Water Lily answered. The little robin came inside and stood there, pouting her lips and frowning to keep back the tears. Then, all of a sudden, apparently having conquered herself, she went limp where she stood and crumbled to the floor, all joints giving away at once. When finally settled, she was in perfect sitting position, as became her sex. With both legs flexed toward the right, a prim little copy of the women about her, already at 4 years of age, it was a habit. Before Water Lily could think how to interest her in something, other mothers had come with their little ones and turned them in. They too were going to the death. Sister, this one will sit with you. Now you mind your mother. If she does not mind, sister, tell me when I return. Cousin, I am leaving my youngest. He hears very well, the little thing. He will... Just tell him to be still. He hears very well. She meant he was quick to obey. Thus, before long, Water Lily had 8 small children on her hands while the mothers went off to wail over the dead. She had no trouble in keeping them happy. Actually, they managed that themselves, playing quietly at various pastimes. At the start, they were politely aware of her and stopped every time she glanced at them to explain in full detail what they were playing. But after a while, they forgot her and went into their activities in earnest, leaving Water Lily to work uninterrupted. At noon, she fed them all. As they sat around her outdoor fire, and in the afternoon she took them for a walk to the wood. They found many tree mushrooms that stuck out from the trunks or branches like immense white ears. It was because of this they were called tree ears. The tree ears on box alder and cottonwood were especially preferred, in that order. So succulent and flavorsome were they when cooked with dried buffalo meat. The children pried them off with poles and let them fall, unbroken if possible, into the blanket that Water Lily held below to catch them. When the little party reached home late in the day, they found the mothers back, cooking for their families around their outdoor fires. Red-eyed and weary, the women sighed and sniffled eloquently now and then. Otherwise, they refrained from needless conversation, as became their mood after weeping over the dead. Only the senior wife, Taluta, was articulate. "So many deaths lately, so many, that I must wail again and again until my eyes are dimmed. My head, too, how it throbs." And she commenced binding her head tightly with a strip of doeskin. But she was not complaining. The truth was that she took a certain pride in fulfilling all her kinship and social duties well, down to commiserating the bereaved and the wailing for the dead, for the good woman had a reputation to uphold. She never misses a death, no matter how humble the one who has died. How good she is! Humans should care for each other so, and should take time to honor one another's passing. Oh, may great crowds throng her teepee when it comes her time to go. It is as she deserves. People often said this of her. She was not going to let them down. Instead of one death, there had been several, and the woman had gone about wailing from one to another. "Oh, yes, I know I overdid it today. After three places, I was coming home to rest. But when I passed a teepee where a strange young man lay unmourned, I had to stop and wail over him, too. I always say that while I live, no human shall go out in utter stillness like an animal," the senior wife declared, lying down after binding her head. The fact was that the epidemic was spreading, and the new blankets which the sons of Buffalo Boy had brought home were infested with deadly germs, against which the people had no immunity. Through several giveaways and also as simple courtesy gifts, those blankets had been changing owners and carrying smallpox from teepee to teepee. The people, however, did not connect the sudden series of deaths with the new blankets, and at the same time that they were frightened by the disease, they welcomed the carriers of it. Good Hunter returned from the council teepee and went straight to his daughter Echo. Water Lily, who owed him avoidance respect, slipped quickly into her own teepee when she saw him coming, so as not to hamper him in what he might have to say to Echo. But teepee walls being only skin deep, she could not help overhearing him, for Echo's home was next to hers. "Daughter, too many people are dying too fast," he said. "It is now plain to the council that the matter is grave and likely to grow worse. Once before, this same many sore sickness visited our camp circles, and many, many people died of it. So before any of our group gets it, you must leave and stay in the wilds until it is safe for you to return. That way, you can escape the sickness. Stay somewhere along Buzzard Creek. I will send for you when it is right."
"Of course, Father, since you say so," Echo replied.
"Tell my son-in-law to have the horses ready so that you can leave at dawn. Take your sister-in-law with you, and your mother also. Already she has partly sickened herself from wailing so much. It will be best for her to get away. Take what you will need of food and clothing, but travel light. Luckily,
There is always plenty of game along the Buzzard. In the hills on either side there are deer. When your brother returns, I will send him out to you. He and his brother-in-law will get all the food you need until this danger passes. Through all this, Echo kept up a wordless lullaby to the infant in her arms, whistling it between her teeth as women did to put babies to sleep. But she was also considering the manner. She asked, "And what of the others? My brothers, sisters, and cousins, and their families? What of my middle mother and my youngest mother? And what of you, father?" "They must all go, but in different parties and in different directions. Each group is better off alone. Your mothers will take their own children. As for me, I am staying here. For myself, I have no fear of the sickness, and I shall not be sick. Do not be concerned for me, my daughter." When Echo came in to tell Water Lily, she repeated what her sister-in-law knew already and was planning for. Echo told her not to bother about a teepee. Her travel tent was big enough for the five adults in the party, herself and her husband, Water Lily and Sacred Horse, and the mother. Echo's four children would fit in wherever they could. She would, of course, keep the baby with her. Robin could stay with her grandmother, and the lad of nine, whom they called Little Bear, could occupy a small space with his younger brother, who was Robin's twin. "When we leave our home teepee standing and our things just as they are," Echo went on, "close your entryway and tie down the door flap against stray dogs. Everything will be safe then. Your father-in-law is staying, and he will look after our teepees and weight them down in case of storms or high winds. If my brother returns tonight, tell him at once that we leave at dawn. He should get home tonight. He has been gone 2 nights and 3 days already." "Yes, I shall tell him first thing," Water Lily said this for something to reply. To herself, she was making rapid calculations on what to take. Around midnight, Sacred Horse did come in. When Water Lily wakened, she heard him sighing from weariness, and she could tell from his movements that he sat smoking in the honor place. Her first impulse was to ask about his trip and tell him of their urgent plans to run away in the morning. But something checked her. This was no time to question him. She must wait until he volunteered to talk. Her own mother's wisdom in all wifely conduct was her guide. Bluebird never chattered idly on when Rainbow first got home. In a matter-of-fact way, she always went about making him comfortable and providing a meal for him, speaking only if he asked a question of her, and then briefly. Not that she feared him, not that he was ever domineering, but she sensed when not to get in his way. When he was tired, let him be. Once she silenced the always eager Ohia when he began flooding his father with questions. "Son, remember this," she told him then. "When a man toils all day for his family and comes home tired out, he does not feel like talking at once. Until your father is rested, and then maybe he will tell you things." Remembering that advice, Water Lily sat up slowly and said aloud to herself, "He is back. I must get him something to eat." She did not oblige him to answer, but when she started up her fire in the middle of the teepee, working easily from where she was, he said, "No, don't cook anything for me.
just some broth, if any remains in the kettle. He sipped it slowly, drawing it in audibly at each sip, as though it were an effort. He had ridden without rest all the way. When he finished the broth, he told her about his trip and gave her the presents that his distant relatives had sent to her. "And now for some sleep," he said. "I'm completely exhausted." And only then did Water Lily tell him the news. "There is something you must hear first, something your sister said to tell you as soon as you returned." She proceeded to relate everything that had happened since the night they went visiting together, when a few people died. And now more and more were sick. Many had died, and more were dying, she said. He listened without comment, and she went on. "My father-in-law has ordered us to scatter in small groups and stay out, away from other people. We are to form one party with your sister and her family and your own mother." "Very well. When do we start?" "As soon as it is light enough to see, we are setting out. And I think it would be well if the horses we need were to stand ready outside." "You think right." And then he began planning aloud. "Two horses. More would be a bother. One is not enough. The bay can carry the drag and the things we need. You will ride it. The sorrel for me. He is fast and I can move on him quickly if necessary." "Yes, the bay and the sorrel." So saying, and suddenly unmindful of his weariness, he went swiftly back out into the night. So, we stop our reading here today. And, of course, we will pick it up next week and to see how they all move from camp in order to try to save themselves from the sickness of smallpox, which was, as we know, which was planted in the blankets that were given to, you know, our relatives at that time. And so many, many people are again being lost from this sickness. I mean, they have no immunity to it. So next week, we will see where they go and set up camp and find out how their lives progress in the midst of the sickness. So once again, I want to say Pidamia to all the listeners out there. Of course, you are listening to Ohomani Iotaka. I am your host, Donna Hawkes, and wishing everybody a week full of good health and happiness. So, doksha ake. We will meet again. This program is made possible with funding from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting.